Bassett, you and your team, welcome. The head of the delegation from the State Law Advisors Office, Kuliswa, is her name, has lost her father. We were just informed this morning, and our thoughts and prayers go with her on behalf of the committee. If you could please convey that to her and family. But that doesn't mean that we left high and dry. We are very capable people here from the office. Kuliswa. It's the lady who normally sits here with the team from the State Law Advisors. She lost her father, and hence she's not here. This morning we're going to deal with the Protection from Harassment Bill, and at our last meeting we left Mr. Bassett and his team with certain instructions, and I take it you're going to take us through those, Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that's indeed the case. You gave us some instructions and we hope that we've understood them and complied with them to your satisfaction. There are two documents that we sent up yesterday. One, if I can refer to it, is a dirty document. It's the document with all the changes to date as a result of deliberations. And then the clean document is really the bill as introduced with the latest set of amendments as proposed by the committee. So the committee will have the benefit of seeing everything that was done in the dirty document and then a more cleaned up document. As I say, that's easier to read. The dirty document, the amendments in purple are the latest set of amendments that we did since last week. And then the clean document, if you've got coloured documents, are in red and white. Red and black, I'm sorry. And then we also circulated a document this morning, Chair. It's a document dealing with sexual harassment. We haven't made any changes to sexual harassment definition, but we did distribute the document where there are various definitions from various pieces of legislation. What I would like to say is that our definition of sexual harassment, we try to encapsulate important elements of the various definitions and try to include them in one definition as contained in the bill for the committee's consideration. Thank you. I'm going to ask Mr. Robertson and Ms. Clark to take us through the changes. Before I do that, I also want to say, since we submitted the document yesterday, we've also gone through the document again and compared it to the bill and checked it, and we have picked up a few mistakes, but we'll highlight them as we go along.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Ronis. I think for purposes of this proceedings, I'm going to use the clean lab bill. I'm going to use the cleaned up version of the bill. Where
he's very tall, this clock. He's far from the
Hello? Book. Anybody hear me?
All right, let's see if we can.
Okay, Mr. Nonis, I'm going to use the cleanup bill, not a dirty document, to take the committee through the amendments to the bill that has been affected to the bill. Some of the amendments were already discussed, the new amendments have been inserted. Yes, okay, I'll sort them. On page 2, in the long title of the bill, we did amend the long title, and by inserting a phrase into ADA in relation to the Criminal Procedure Act of 1955, where we also want to include for better description the phrase and to provide a mechanism to subpoena witnesses to attend proceedings in terms of that act. At the bottom of page 2, under paragraph A, the word harassing behavior is substituted with harassment. Page 2 of the bill, I believe Mr. Jeffrey pointed out that he's got a problem with his arm, and we reconsider the matter, and we want to substitute that with a definition of with a definition, weapon. And we also, in considering this definition, included the definition of dangerous weapon under that definition as a paragraph B. However, we want to affect the following amendment to paragraph B of the definition. The word firearm, we don't deem it necessary to include that as well. It's actually a problem if you do include it, due to the fact that if you read that description, it merely indicates that anything other than a firearm can be considered as a dangerous weapon. And we want to take the word firearm out and reword that paragraph as follows. Any object other than any object other than that provided for in paragraph A, which is likely to cause serious bodily harm if it were used to commit an assault. That will mean that everything else than a firearm or a handgun or air gun or ammunition as defined in the Firearms Control Act that can cause serious bodily harm will be considered as a weapon for purposes of the Act. This will have consequential amendments to the bill. Inter alia, clause 7.2a, the option under clause 7.2, as well as clause 9. Okay, then at the bottom of page 3, the definition of dangerous weapon should be deleted.
I'm happy with this, but I just wanted to, do we assume that if nobody says anything, then there's happiness with the amendment? Because it would be better to deal with each section as we come to it. There aren't that many.
No.
So I'm happy.
Right.
I've got nothing to say, but it would just be then, presumably, if anybody's unhappy, they will be speaking.
Or if you have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
The definitions, because it starts with W, so we'll just include it right at the end of the definition.
Sure.
On page 4 of the document, two definitions were inserted, electronic communication identity number and electronic communication service provider. That is to provide for a new clause, clause 3A, that was inserted in the bill, inter alia, to provide for the electronic tracking of harassers.
Now I've got a problem. We're being taken then over previous amendments that we've been through. I would have thought it would have been better to have stuck to the purple amendments, because we've dealt with electronic communications identity number. Would that not be better? Because otherwise we're then rehashing what we did last week.
Okay, you don't want them take us through and make sure that they've covered everything we thought they would. You happy with that?
You see, Chair, we did these two, for example, in red, the electronic communication service. There are no amendments that were affected from the last meeting. So they went through these amendments last week. Or was it last week, the week before last week? So we're just hearing it again. Obviously, if somebody's got a problem with an amendment that didn't come up last time, then let them raise it. But what they would be doing now is what they did last week.
All right. Okay, Mr. Robinson, let's go back then.
Okay, let's go to the definition of sexual harassment.
Maybe Mr. Robinson should use the dirty version, because dirty, you can see the... You've deleted, you've affected the changes on harm, which I'm happy with as well. Basically, that harm is as it stood in the bill. Option one and option two have gone. But I just think maybe it might be easier to use the dirty version, and we can see the purple.
Refer then to the colored version of the document, or the dirty version. It's page 7. Let's start from the beginning. We left out amendment. It's on page 3.
Yeah.
It's the definition of core day.
That's right.
That was deleted. In the bill, we actually, if we need to prescribe or refer to a core day, we named it an ordinary core day. I think it's clear. Can maybe just refer the members to the various definitions of core day that appears in different legislation. The Magistrates Courts Act or the rules does not define core day, neither does the Supreme Court Act or the Interpretation Act. In various rules of or the rules of the High Court, the Constitutional Court, and the rules of the Labour Court, reference is made to a core day, and that is defined as any day excluding Saturday, Sunday, or a public holiday. But we agree we can delete it here. Okay, on page 4, the original definition of harm stays as it is. On page 5, we've deleted that definition of sexual harassment, and we stick to the omni definition of sexual harassment, which is contained on page 7. This includes the proposals by AVUSA. Firstly, it's the guilt requirement that was inserted here, and also the proposal by the committee that sexual harassment should be explicitly be included in this definition. The defenses to sexual harassment that was originally contained in this definition has been deleted here. We provide for two options how to deal with that, and then I'll discuss that later on. Then it's there's some minor amendments to the definition of sexual harassment. It's on page 8. Mainly by also including or a related person, which can also be harassed.
On that, my related person.
You want protection order because you're being sexually harassed, but in fact, the conduct that you're wanting the order of protection from, which is sexual harassment, humiliated a related person. I don't understand why you need the related person.
In terms of harassment, harassment takes place where the complainant is harassed or a related person. A related person is usually somebody close to the complainant. So a complainant can actually, if a related person is kind of harassed, also feel harassed and go to the court to apply for a protection order. It's usually where a related person, certain acts is done to a related person to get to the complainant, that the complainant may feel harassed. And I think sexual harassment as such can take place in relation to a related person. Let's take an example of the university where, let's say my daughter is being harassed, maybe by means of conduct that amounts to sexual harassment, inter alia to get to me. I think I'm fully entitled then to apply in my own standing for a protection order against harassment.
That it then does apply to sexual harassment.
I'm not sure whether Sarah was going to point those out. I've also just picked up a few In the definition of harassment, paragraph C, it's where you're unreasonably sending, delivering, or causing the delivery of letters, telegrams, packages, facsimiles, electronic mail, or other objects to the complainant or related person, or leaving them, I think it should read, where they will be found, just from a grammatical point of view, and then the same would apply in the option for harassment. If the committee is happy with that, just really from a grammatical point.
You know, it's not leaving it, it's them.
Yeah.
Where they
will be found.
Mr. Chairperson, moving to page 10, the option that provided that a person above the age of 18 years may apply on behalf of a child for a protection order has been deleted. Again, page 11, we were requested by the committee and earlier to move the defences to harassment, to inter alia, I think it was recommended, clause 3. I refer to clause 2, where we inserted the words subject to subsection 3A. That means that clause 2 will be subject to subsection 3A, which actually contain a reference to the defences. So in terms of clause 2, a court may make or can consider the issuing of interim protection order, but then the defences must also be taken into account. And if you go to page 12, we made provision for the defences to harassment, which has been included. The wording is substantially the same. We have played a bit with the words, and it reads now, the court may in its discretion refuse to issue an interim protection order pending a hearing in terms of section 6.2 if the court is of the opinion that a conduct in question might, on the balance of probabilities, A, be reasonable, or B, we've put in the heading of paragraph B alternative, have been engaged in or have taken place, and then the defences are, as was included in the bill previously, has been included in here. This must be read in conjunction with clause 6.4. I believe you already pointed out to the committee that offences to harassment, specific defences to harassment, may be problematic. In the bill there's a paragraph at the bottom where we explain it. I just want to point out that if the defence part is moved to clause 3, it may be problematic. In terms of clause 3, the court is usually considering the ex parte application. That means there's no opposing party. And from our point of view, it may be problematic for courts to inter alia without any evidence from any other party, come to the conclusion that there might be a legitimate offence to harassment if the complainant makes an application for an interim protection order. That is why we give the court the discretion here, but it's our submission that this defence should actually be included in terms of clause 6 of the bill, where the court actually hears the application, and a court can then, after it has taken all the views into account of all the different parties, come to a conclusion whether the defence is valid or not.
JJ? Followed by Debbie.
Yeah, look, I agree with the footnote. I don't think this belongs here. Remember, it's a two-stage process. You get this urgent interim protection order, which is on a prima facie, on the face of it, basis. I mean, granted, if there's a prima facie case that you're being harassed. If you've got to allow the court to hear the, and those urgent applications, interdicts effectively, don't give the court deals with the issue at a later point when it decides whether to make the order final or not. So my worry about the defense is it's going to make interim protection orders more difficult to be obtained. And I think the whole purpose of the bill is this person is being harassed, they're feeling threatened, let them get the interim order and balance the rights up by later allowing a proper hearing into the matter. So I would agree that I don't think we want 3A.
Just 3A?
Yeah. I'll come on to other stuff later, but in terms of this is about the interim protection order, that under the interim protection order, that the inclusion of option A, 3A, is going to complicate matters.
I think that's probably right. We need to look at it later on because it will make it more difficult. But my query is in respect of A. Why do we actually say that if it's reasonable when the definition of harassment requires it to be unreasonable?
Well, I believe this was the proposals by a wizard, and it was included like that, and we agree with that, that the
definition requires it to be unreasonable. So, can we take it up?
Yeah.
Well, I'll just add that it's actually our contention that it's not really necessary to have these defences at all, because it is encapsulated in the unreasonableness at the outset.
Indicated that they would like to consider these defences at a later stage as well, so I think...
Yeah, that was my recollection.
But Chair, because it's a two-stage thing, we're dealing with defences to the interim order. I think then there's agreement that this clause regarding the interim order comes out.
Okay.
I think we can then deal with the detail when we get down to the defences to the final order.
All right.
We're on page 12. Subclause 4 that relates to the serving of documents on the respondent. We requested to include an option there. On the one hand, the option will be to serve the documents in the prescribed manner. The alternative thereto will be in a manner prescribed by the rules of court in question for the service of process, which will have the effect that Rule 9 of the Magistrates Court Act will be applicable. Depending on which way the committee decides, other clauses which actually also make provision for service of documents may need to be considered in that regard. Rule 9 of the Magistrates Court Act provides for the manners in which the documents may be served by the sheriff. By fixing a document to the door of the residence of a person, by the, serving a document personally on a person, or on a person that's over the age of 16 years. I believe I have previously submitted the whole Rule 9 to the committee.
Now, why? I don't remember the discussion on this point, so apologies if I'm rehashing old ground. The way the bill was phrased was that it would be by regulation. The other option then is served in the normal course of service. The prescribed manner gives more flexibility for the regulations to provide for specific serving which may be necessary because this is a special type of order. So I'm not sure why we were saying we wanted it just to be in the normal course as in the rules of the court, and I prefer the prescribed manner because it does give the opportunity for special service if need be. I can't think of one at the moment, but yeah.
Chair, I tend to agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Jeffrey. There are quite a few places in the bill where their service of documents comes up, and they're all there in the prescribed manner. And I think if you have a look at similar legislation like domestic violence and all that sort of thing, it's all in the prescribed manner. And we do want to have the flexibility of coming up with innovative ways of serving documentation. And I think the regulation prescribed route will facilitate that.
Okay. We agree. On page 13, the option has been deleted and has been incorporated. It was decided by the committee to discard it completely now. Then in page 13, clause 6, relates to when the interim protection order will have force and effect. The committee indicated that they want the latter option, that the protection order will have force and effect from the time it is issued by a court and the existence thereof is brought to the attention of the respondent. Previously, in terms of the other definition that was originally in the Act, the interim protection order will only have force and effect once it is served on the respondent. The definition that is actually kept is in line with the law relating to interdicts. On page 14, as an alternative to the amendments to clauses 3 and 6 relating to offences, there's also the other option to include the defences as a separate loose-standing clause in the bill. I think the effect is basically more or less the same. But then again, if you include it as a loose-standing clause, it will affect proceedings from the start. It has been included as clause 3AA on page 14. And the wording is basically the same as has previously been discussed.
Can we deal with the defences under 6? I think, because I think we've said no defences for the interim protection order.
All right.
I just wondered I don't know if Mr. Roberts is going to raise it because there weren't that many changes, but Dr. Ambrosini had the next section at the beginning on 2-3-A. Dr. Ambrosini raised with myself and Mr. Swart.
And with me.
Oh, and with you, okay. Oh, okay, with everybody then. He's got around. So do I need to raise it then?
Should we discuss it now?
Well, it comes under this. It comes under the electronic communications provided to furnish particulars to the court, and this is this new section. Well, the section under clause on page 14. There's so many 3As. So, I think this is But it was really just that his problem about. And look, he spoke to other members of the committee, so I might have it wrong, but this way I understand it, his problem about the a person blogging or whatever under the security that their identity will not be known, and somebody applying for harassment order against them, and their identity then being revealed. And he also made a point about worried about the internet service providers would have to incur more responsibilities. Now, and he raised the point about internet service providers coming here. Now, the issue. Yeah, so he basically was hoping this issue would be left. But my question is really, is there any greater do does the bill provide for the internet service providers having to maintain any records that they don't normally have to maintain? That was my okay. This Mr. Robertson shakes his head. That was my understanding.
Yeah.
So that was his one concern. I don't know, but my fear is if you don't include this, if you don't allow, because of the anonymity of the internet, if you don't allow for some procedure to get the identity of the person, and the procedure that we've provided for is that it has to be a court that orders, and that notice has to be given to the person, short notice, maximum of 24 hours, that they're going to release the name. So there are checks and balances, but unless you provide for an ability to get the identity, you've got no way of dealing with cyber harassment or cyber stalking. But I don't know, before you give Mr. Roberts, I'd suggest maybe just other members that Dr. Ambrosini spoke to may want to express their views.
Mr. Chair, it is a difficult issue. His argument is that harassment is not a crime. Okay?
Yeah.
And because it's not a crime, then the invasion of somebody else's anonymity is invading freedom of speech. Now, I mean, I said to him, well, you should have freedom of speech anyway. You shouldn't have to be anonymous to have it. But there are some people I know in my party who are very concerned about being able to keep anonymity on the internet. So I wouldn't object if there's any way we could keep this open for Dr. Ambrosini to come back and, you know, have another discussion on it. I would like the advisors' opinions as well, because on the one hand we don't want to protect harassers either.
Yeah.
If it's genuine harassment, I mean, what are the opportunities for abuse really? I mean, we kind of assume people will run off to court, and they might. You know, if someone says something they don't like about you, then they might say that's harassment. So I think there is a possibility for abuse, and I do think we need to just be careful about it.
I think what Mr. Ambrosini said to me this morning was that we had somehow, and Vonani confirmed this, we had somehow agreed that we would relook their submission firstly, and then take a decision as to whether we should invite them back. Now, so essentially that's what I'm putting on to you. Should we invite them back? Service providers, yes.
In the submission, what is it that we want to engage with them on? Because that's more detail of how.
Yeah.
The issue that Debbie's raising is more policy issue. It's more policy issue. Steve had raised with me, I don't know if you know, the seriousness of internet harassment in terms of children committing suicide because of harassment on the net. So it is quite serious. But I'm not sure whether Dr. Ambrosini's point was a greater burden of responsibility on the internet service provider, but it doesn't seem, and Mr. Roberts has confirmed it, it doesn't seem as though there's any greater responsibility on providing what they already have. You know, it's not like RICO, which was a huge lot of responsibilities. So I wouldn't want to just blindly agree to calling the internet service providers until we know what it is that we actually want to get from them. Because this procedure is basically you get the you don't know who it is, the court issues the direction to the electronic communications service provider, and to give the ID number where the electronic communications ID number where the harassment originated from, who the name, identity number, and address of the person who has been assigned that number, and any other sort of information. And then the communication service provider can ask for more time on the grounds that the information cannot be provided timeously, or cancellation on the grounds that it does not provide an electronic communication service to either the respondent or the complainant or related person, or the information is not available. So if they don't have the information, they don't have the information.
My sense was that it's rather a case of the service providers wanting to get something from us.
What?
Well, a reaction of what we have here. I think they're concerned with being cited. Quite clearly, that's what they're afraid of, being cited every time. Because they have to release the person's identity. But
the policy of does this bill cover cyber harassment?
Yeah.
And if it does, which I think it should, then that's the only logical outcome.
Yeah.
The only thing is that it's actually going to be quite limiting in the sense of we can only issue one of these against a South African company, and the majority of these actually are overseas companies.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, I think it is essentially a policy issue which we need to discuss maybe further at some point, but not today.
Okay. The only thing is we need to finalise. We've got legislation mounting. I thought we had had the discussion. I mean, I hear what Ms. Schaefer is saying and her concern, but it's a fairly fundamental issue. So I'm not trying to push the thing, but then what form of discussion? I don't think there's any point in the service providers coming, because it's something we can deal with without them. I think the section and the wording should be sent to them for comment, for technical input, which I think it has already. Yeah, it has already. But then, as far as the policy decision as to whether this bill is going to apply to cyber stalking, I don't know then whether we should have a specific meeting on it or what the case should be. But we do need we really need to have this bill passed before we leave. Otherwise, yeah.
Is there anything new that we need to discuss, Debbie, that we haven't already discussed? Sure, that's different. I think we can allow that. But can we agree that we don't call the service providers? Okay, that's done. Okay. Mr. Bassett first, Mr. Robertson, then you.
Thanks, Chair. I think we must recognize the fact that the bill, when it was introduced into Parliament, made provision for. There was a provision that for cyber stalking. Because it says, as harassment means engaging in verbal, electronic, or any other.
Yeah.
So I think that was the intention, and this 3A is really nothing more than a mechanism to help it. And if I remember correctly, the mechanism was put in because there was an outcry from the comments that we received that the bill doesn't go far enough. So I think we must just bear that in mind. Then, as I think Sarah will say, that the service providers are happy with this provision. They're happy to help. They're going to get paid for it because the bill makes provision for payment of tariffs. So I don't think from that point of view they've already indicated their willingness to cooperate. But as you indicated, Chair, they're very opposed to the prior notification because they're going to become involved in litigation. So that they're not going to be happy with. So if they do come back, they're going to really squeal about that, because they've indicated quite clearly that they don't like it. And I think, as Mr. Jeffrey said, referring to what Mr. Swart said, that cyber stalking can be very serious. And I think one has to have a look at the right to privacy of the stalker as well as the right to privacy of the victim.
Yes.
So it's a balancing act. And
I think Mr. Roberts before you.
No, Chair, just to confirm what JJ said, I think we need to take cyber stalking
quite seriously. You've got Facebook, you've got Twitter, all these type of things. And what has concerned me is one reads the reports of youngsters, high school people that are being stalked or bullied almost on the cyber. And I've read reports of them committing suicide, you know, and they're very... So we need to take it seriously, and I would support the retention of this clause, that we need to look very carefully at how we word it, but the concept I definitely support.
And just maybe point out... Let's
hear Mr. Jeffrey, please.
Point out that I mean, electronic communication service provider is South African, I think. If you look at the definition, an entity licensed or exempted from being licensed in terms of Chapter 3 of the Electronic Communications Act. So presumably the bill does not provide for the scope. If I'm not sure exactly who that covers, but presumably the bill does not provide for the scope for if you having to apply to external courts.
Okay, maybe regarding the last question, yes, it's only limited to service providers in South Africa that is resorts under the Electronic Communications Act. That is, electronic communication service providers that has been licensed or was exempted from being licensed. And that is also the only electronic communication service providers in a republic. I think it's a universal thing that it's difficult to enforce orders of this nature outside the boundary of your country. It's like legislation in other countries may be completely different, and there's also privacy laws that is definitely different to that in the Republic. We can maybe refer to certain Russian service providers which actually allow harassment on its websites, and they will never give you the identity of the person, so you cannot enforce it outside the boundaries of the country. Firstly, I can confirm that most of the service providers actually agrees to the clause. It's only clause 306 that relates to the notification of the respondent that they actually opposed of. And I think the reason is extra administrative burden. But I think there is general consensus amongst them that firstly, there's no extra responsibilities on them, and secondly, that RICA database is available for these purposes. Regarding checks and balances, I just want to refer to clause 301. One of the big checks and balances in terms of this clause is in the area that you have to make out a prima facie case that you are being harassed. It's only then that section 3A will kick in. So if you cannot convince a court that you are being harassed, a court will never issue a direction in terms of clause 3A. In any event, if there's a false application, I believe there's various offences that is available in criminal law for persons who make false statements to a court. Statutory perjury as well as common law perjury. And there's also offence, I think, in terms of the Magistrates Courts Act, if you make certain statements to a court that's false. And that is about as far as I can take it.
All right.
Also, there's clause 13 in the bill that makes provision for vexatious proceedings. The court can actually impose a cost order on you. Okay, and then moving on to page 15. At the bottom of the page, sub-clause 2, it relates to the direction how it must be served. The committee requested us to take out the functionaries that do that, and only the functionaries that serve the direction, and that we must provide for a process by means of subordinate legislation. So it now reads in a prescribed manner, and it's left to, it can be prescribed in regulation how it must be done. Then on page 16, subclause 3, that is the first amendment to Core Day. Since we deleted the definition, we now specify it as 4 ordinary core days. And also under paragraph B, similar. The next page, clause 17. That relates to the informing function of the electronic communication service provider. The option that was deleted provided that electronic communication service provider must inform the respondent after the information has been given to a court. The option that was retained by the committee actually provided that the respondent must be informed 24 hours before the information is furnished to the court. On page 18, nothing. Page 19.
Just on that point, I mean, this is one of the checks and balances that we're putting in. Why did we, though, decide on 24 hours? I'm just sort of wondering whether it improves the check and balance if we give more time.
I believe in terms of the law, the proposed time period within which electronic communication service provider must provide information to the court is 4 core days. And in some instances, I believe in terms of RICA, the information is readily available, but some service providers, mainly fixed line operators, it may take a bit longer.
I'm talking about the 24 hours. Why do we only give the respondent 24 hours notice?
Okay, that relates to the time period within which the... if a service provider only has got 4 core days to submit the information to the court, it might be problematic for them if you allow a longer period, like 48 hours, to inform a person. You are really going to overburden some of the electronic communication service providers to obtain that information before that 48 hours in order to, in any event, submit it within 4 core days. On the one hand, you actually then ask them actually to obtain information within 2 core days, so they can comply with the 4 core days statutory requirement, and also to comply with the 48 hours statutory requirement. And it might be conflicting to an effect.
The issue would be, do we not want to improve the check and balance by saying 48 hours and then make it 5 court days?
All right. Honourable members, are you okay with that? All right. So it's 48 hours and 5 court days.
Page 19, relates to clause 3B, 3B1B, in paragraph 3, the third line, we inserted the name and address of the respondent, or obtaining, it's been indicated. It's just to make the sentence read better. The same has been done on page 20 in subclause 3B2. Page 21. relates to clause 3C.
Just on technical amendments, can I bring to the committee's attention? In clause 3A, my pages I think are different to the ones your document is, but it's clause 3A 1B1. The court may issue a direction in the prescribed form directing an electronic communication service provider to furnish the court in the prescribed manner by means of an affidavit in the prescribed form with electronic communications identity number, the word from must be inserted after number, from where the Harris electronic communication or electronic mail originated. And then in subparagraph 3, just from down there, is any information which indicates that electronic communications or electronic mail were or were not, because it's referred to electronic communications. Thank you.
Then the sum must come out at the end.
Yes. All right. Okay.
It's 21 then of the document. The powers of the police to trace a person or the respondent that has harassed a complainant. The committee asked the department to investigate inter alia of whether the South African police will not have, in any event, have the powers to inter alia obtain a person's name and address, and to investigate the matter if it's not a criminal matter. I think the committee last time said that if that is the effect, that they actually do have that powers, that we must redraft the specific clause. But if they don't have that powers, we can give them that powers in terms of clause 3C. We have looked at the various legislation applicable to the South African Police Services. The start of point will be section 205 of the Constitution, which prescribes that the South African Police Service will have only that powers that is actually specifically conferred upon them by way of legislation. The South African Police Service Act actually regulates the powers and duties of the South African Police. In terms of that act, there is no specific powers to investigate or inclusively to obtain a name and address from a person. If you look at the South African Criminal Procedure Act and the authorities, inter alia the two way commentaries on the Criminal Procedure Act, you will say that the South African Police Service will not have any powers unless it's specifically conferred upon them by way of legislation, and that specifically relates to criminal investigations, which is traditionally the functions of the South African Police. So even if the Criminal Procedure Act don't give specific powers to police, you cannot assume that they do have that powers. So there's no legislation that gives the South African Police the authority to investigate a matter or to obtain a name of address of a person if it's not criminal related. If it's criminal related, section 41 of the South African Criminal Procedure Act will be applicable. In light of that, we retain certain clauses in clause 3C, certain provisions in clause 3C. The first one is the discretionary powers that is given to the police to investigate a matter. And that is in 3C1A. But we made a subject there too, that the manner how they must investigate stalking or alleged stalking must be set out in the national instructions that must be issued in terms of section 17.2 of the bill. We retain the provision that the member of the South African Police may request the respondent to furnish his name and address to that police member. And again, the manner and how it should be done should be set out in the national instructions that will be issued in terms of clause 17.2 of the bill. What we took out from the initial clause is the powers of the police to the obligation of the police to identify himself, and also the draconian powers of the police to arrest the person if it's suspected that such a person gives the South African police a false name of address, and to detain that person for a period of up to 8 hours. That is on page 21 and 22.
No, look, it was. I also checked with people in the police who also felt it wouldn't be a bad thing to specify the optional power. My only point was under 3C1A. This is the optional section. I just think it's there's two requirements. Well, three requirements really. There has to be oath or affirmation. The information has to be provided, so the complainant needs to have made an affidavit. And the two are that the two requirements are reasonable grounds for believing that the respondent is engaging in or has engaged in harassment, and the complainant intends applying for a protection order. Mine is and obviously that's crucial. There's no point in getting the police to investigate if the person is not, and it's a requirement that they have to be put under oath. My problem is more just the wording of it. I would have thought the requirement of the intention to apply for a protection order is the first point. And then the second point then is the reasonable grounds for believing, the police having reasonable grounds for believing that there's been harassment. But so I don't know if one and two can be swapped around, but my other problem then is that if it appears from information that there are reasonable grounds, it appears from information. So that does apply to one. But it's a bit sloppy when it comes to if it appears from information on oath or affirmation that the complainant intends applying. But if you get my point, I would have rather have said, the complainant has stated under oath that they intend applying, not may if it appears. Then you've got this sort of vague thing, did they actually say they were going to apply for a protection order? So basically what I'm saying is the may if it appears from information should apply to one, but two needs to be more specific. The complainant has stated under oath that they intend applying for a protection order. I don't know if that makes sense.
Makes sense. That'd
be the first requirement, because if they come and complain to the police about harassment, but they're actually a bit vague as to whether they want a protection order, then the police shouldn't have to be looking at it. It should be a thing of I'm intending applying for a protection order, and I put that under oath, and then why do I want the protection order, and why do I need you to help me find the name of the person?
Okay, Debbie, and then
so, Chair, my reading of the section is that is also under oath.
No, they're both under oath. It's just more, my problem is that the wording may, if it appears from information on oath, that the complainant intends applying for a protection order. And I don't like the vagueness of may, if it appears from information. May, if it appears from information.
Must.
The South African police may, if the complainant has stated under oath that they intend applying for a protection order.
Okay. All right.
It's clearer than if it appears, you know?
Yeah. Right. I think you've got that, Mr. Robertson.
Yeah. I just also want to alert the committee then also to the fact that all related persons must be included if you
you want to look at the Roman figure 2, the complainant or related person under oath. Because the related person is allowing the complainant to make the complaint in the first place. So it was, they said if somebody's harassing you or a related person, but the effect is on you, so then you would still be the complainant. Otherwise, the related person would go and make a complaint in their own right.
Moving on to clause 4, related to...
You got Mr. Jeffrey's point, though, eh?
I've got it. Okay,
fine. Just on this related person, because I see it's in here in blue. And I understand why related person is included under the definition of harassment, because the related person gets harassed. I don't understand why the related person is making affidavits to the police. The names and address of the are unknown to the complainant or related person that has been engaged in harassment of the complainant or a related person. But the definition of harassment includes or related person. So I don't know why you need to put or related person again there, and the complainant is going to be asking for the protection order, not the related person. That's why they're the related person and not the complainant. So definitely the second, the harassment of the complainant or related person, that or related person should go, because harassment includes harassment of a related person. 3C1. Then it's a question of whether whether the related person needs to have no knowledge of the name or address. I suppose that could stay, but yeah.
If the related person knows who the person is, then you don't need to go to the police. So, I mean...
It leaves the first related person to take up the statement. But I mean, is there agreement, am I right, that harassment of the complainant or related person is a tautology, because you've already included or related person in the definition of harassment. Okay.
Are we okay with that, Mr. Robertson? Second one comes out? Okay.
And moving on, clause 4, it starts on page 22. Page 23, it relates to where court can order a person to produce any book, document, or thing. The word thing substituted with the word object.
Okay. We had a lot of fun with that the last time.
And then moving on to page 25.
Sorry, Chair, just to take it. Also, technical thing on clause 3C3B is be provided to the court by means of an affidavit in the prescribed form.
Sorry, 3 what?
It's 3C.
Yes.
Sub clause 3B. Be provided to the court by means of an affidavit in the prescribed form. Has it there already? Okay, in the clean document, it doesn't seem to be like that. Okay, it's in the clean document that there seems to be a slip up.
All right, so you need to correct that then.
Okay, page 25, it deals with clause 6, that relates to the consideration of the application for protection order, your option has been inserted after clause 3, that provides for defences. I think Mr. Jeffrey wants the defences to harassment actually to be included. When the court finally considered the protection order. So basically, Pospor's amended by the addition of the words before the original paragraph of subject to subsection 4A, and then we inserted the defences as 4A. So that in effect will mean that a court must, after a hearing, issue a protection order, but this is subject to the defences which a court must consider, and in which instance a court may not grant a protection order. The defences set out is the same as was previously stated when we discuss it as the separate offence as well as under clause 3.
I'm not sure why this, on my version, there's an option C. I don't know why it's option C. I mean, to my mind, the original clause 4, which states the test is a balance of probabilities, that needs to remain. Okay, so there's no option about it. Okay. The issue then is whether one lists these defenses. And to start from where Debbie left off, a defense of reasonableness is a tautology because it's a requirement of unreasonableness in the definition of harassment. So you don't need to say if the court finds that the conduct was reasonable. Because before it even gets to the court doesn't have to determine whether the conduct was reasonable. The court has to determine whether the conduct was unreasonable. Okay, so that aspect of on the top of page 26, the A is unnecessary. Then B is basically the Avusa Sanef media exemption clause. And actually, I have a problem with it because effectively it will give exemptions to the media from this bill. I don't think it applies in other jurisdictions. I mean, the media can harass. It's basically if you are, whatever you're doing, if you're trying to detect an offence, then you're excluded from this bill. So that's a defense. You know, the court must of the opinion that the conduct took place for the purpose of detecting an offense. So you're a journalist, you can basically harass as much as you want. The media, when they themselves came, spoke about the need to keep questioning the person because maybe they'll just change their mind. To my mind, that's saying that the media, that the journalists can then escape from, override the right to remain silent that a person has. So basically, I've got a problem with B. I don't think it's necessary. And then just to remember, And as I said, it specifically really applies to the media. Just remember that the media can, we're not making this a crime, okay? It basically, so we're not saying the media can't go and perpetually ask somebody for comment on something, on the same thing over and over again, or camp outside their house. They can do that. The issue is basically the person can apply to court for a protection order against the media. And only if the court grant the order, then the media have to stop. So I just want to make it sort of clear to basically whoever's recording that one is not opposing the media's right to do investigative journalism. One is just simply dealing with a question of whether the media should be excluded from this bill if somebody wants to apply for a protection order. And I feel that they should not. We have put in other safeguards that Sanef wanted in terms of the definition of harassment and the issue of information in court, but I think excluding, preventing somebody from applying for a protection order against the media, which effectively is what this clause does, is not right.
You may, yeah, and as I said, it does, the decision as to whether the protection order is granted is by the court. It is the case in other jurisdictions,
mm-hmm.
And it's not criminalizing anything. And there are definitely cases where people want, you know, to be protected from the paparazzi, for example.
So basically, I'm proposing the deletion
of 4A and keeping 4 as it remains. The court must determine on a balance of probabilities.
I don't quite understand how the paparazzi has to do with these, because I mean, these are talking about detecting an offence, revealing a threat to public safety, undue advantage in a competitive bidding process, or complying with a legal duty. I don't think paparazzi generally engage in that kind of behaviour. So I'm not sure why we're wanting to exclude this part now, because it doesn't apply to paparazzi. I do agree that media certainly can harass, and I don't think they should be allowed to, you know, harass people on an ongoing basis and be exempt from any remedy. But why, you know, these are quite specific. I mean, the other day we were saying, yes, they often do disclose crimes, and we should be able to allow them to do that.
Steve Swartz, and then you, JJ.
Yes, Chair, I tend to agree with Debbie on the issue. I think we need to look very carefully at this. Here we've got the situation where the court then takes a decision on this issue, on a balance of probabilities, where the court can refuse to issue a protection order. The court sits with a complaint against the media on a balance of probabilities, looks at these issues, and these are some of the overrides that are in PIA, which we know is why PIA is there, the whole issue of access to information. There's also a lot of literature that was provided to us on the international models, and I think we need to look very carefully before we exclude that. I'm not inclined to agree to exclude B at this stage. I think it gives the court, that's not to say that a court cannot find that a journalist has harassed on the balance of probabilities. The court then looks at this, and it's a very narrow exemption, yeah, under B. I agree with that. A, the unreasonableness one can talk about that, but it's a very narrow ambit that is being used here. It's not a broadness, and we see the other side. We see harassment from police, for example. We had that incident with that one journalist. What is his, well, Africa or something? We need to be
silly guys.
Yeah, so we need to strike the balance, the right balance, and one's got to just consider that in the different, and maybe we need to look again at all the literature that's been provided us on the international models. I see there's a whole lot of arguments here either way, the different models that are being used worldwide, and so we just need to be very careful. Thank you, Jim.
Paparazzi I shouldn't have mentioned paparazzi. It doesn't fit in, but basically a journalist, or it actually could, as Mr. Swart mentions it, a police person is perpetually harassing you, wanting comment. Okay, you apply for a court order. In the case of the police person, you say, look, I've told this person I am not prepared to say anything. That's my right. But they keep coming round. The police person says, no, the conduct was engaged in to comply with a legal duty. You cannot grant this order against me. Now, the court has to establish on the balance of probabilities only that that was the case, and the policeman is saying, look, I'm investigating this case. I'm keeping on harassing this person, but I'm doing it to comply with a legal duty. No order. Excluded. Okay? Because it's not, the police person just has to show that they were doing it to comply with a legal duty. That's all. I don't know why Debbie shakes her head, because that is a defense. It's an absolute defense. And then the same with a journalist. We do want journalists to investigate, but we do want to provide for a situation if they go overboard as determined by the court that they've gone overboard, that then there's an opportunity to stop it. But if you read this section, okay, the court may refuse a protection order if their conduct is for the purpose of detecting a crime. So the journalist said, sorry, I'm sort of, you know, harassing you at your child's school when you go and drop them off or pick them up in the morning, but I'm trying to detect a crime that I think you've committed. And the court would then say, well, I can't grant the protection order. So I think it's quite clear that this phrasing is a complete exemption. You know, I don't think the court has much discretion. You know, I know it says in its discretion refuse to issue a protection order, but if I would argue, if you've applied for a protection order, you've got a journalist who is chasing you around shopping centres. The journalist says, no, I was doing it to detect a crime. I don't think you can get the order.
Actually, my understanding is, and if I'm incorrect, then we need to correct it on that basis. But my understanding is it's still a requirement of reasonableness applies. Because it's harassment, it's only harassment if it is unreasonable. And I don't see how these offences can be absolute in isolation of that. I mean, they have to be for the purpose of detecting or preventing an offence as well as being unreasonable. And if that isn't so, then I think we need to make sure that that is so. But, I mean, if it's... then you could argue that it's not unreasonable. I mean, we need to maybe have that debate as to whether it would be regarded as unreasonable, or as reasonable, put it that way, if it is for one of these purposes. But, I mean, I still think the requirement of reasonableness must be applicable, because it's in the definition.
Yeah, but let's use an example, okay? The behaviour has to be unreasonable, obviously. Mm-hmm. So let's use the example of the journalist is basically... trying to get pictures and comment from the person they're investigating at the person's school. I think everybody would agree that's unreasonable behavior. Okay? So that's harassment. Now, in that case, if you apply for a person goes off to court to get a protection order, they prove that it's unreasonable. The defense, because this is so that's a requirement that you've got to establish before you start getting onto defences. The defence then is, no, I was engaged in this, might be unreasonable, it's harassment, but this is now a defence to the unreasonable behaviour. I was engaged in this unreasonable behaviour for the purpose of detecting an offence. How can the court not refuse the order? That's my defence to the order. So unreasonableness is the requirement that comes in for harassment. So all this behavior that you're then applying to court for is unreasonable behavior. So it's not just somebody phoning you once or twice to say, will you comment? It's basically something more substantial than that. But even once you've established it's unreasonable, these are defenses, as everybody is agreed, that they are defenses, and the defense to unreasonable behavior is, no, I was preventing and detecting an offense. And then I think it's also correct to say that you could apply this to members of the police force, where they perpetually keep harassing you to comment, and their behavior is unreasonable. And they then say, no, I'm trying to comply with the legal duty as a policeman to get information.
Maybe the legal people on as
well.
All right. Mr. Robertson?
Well, my opinion is the latter opinion that was expressed by Mr. Jeffrey is actually correct. This is an absolute defense. You can even go so far into idea to say a journalist can break into somebody's house. It's actually committing a crime. It is obviously unreasonable. But then if a protection order is or if the complainant actually then requests for a protection order, it can come back and say, no, I'm covered by this exemptions, and the submission is that the court must then actually come to the conclusion that if he falls under one of these grounds, that a protection order cannot be issued against him.
So if I may also come in at this point, the reason why originally defences weren't included in the proposed bill is because the actions of acting to comply with a legal duty or to detect or prevent an offence is a justification, and that would boil down to reasonableness. So you wouldn't necessarily need these defences in place because you would prove your reasonableness by the manner in which you've acted and the fact that you're acting to detect or prevent an offence or to comply with a legal duty. There's a common law justification for that already in place. So it's unnecessary to list defences which may be absolute in the bill itself.
I mean, if it's a test for reasonableness, I assume it'd be a test for a reasonable journalist or a test for a reasonable police officer. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. On that point, I would have thought that you know, in terms of establishing that there was harassment and that the behaviour was unreasonable, obviously they would have to look at the subjective conditions of each respondent. So if you walk down the lane outside Parliament and someone comes up to you and starts wanting to talk to you, and they keep doing that whenever you walk there, that the court would regard that differently to if the person says, I'm a journalist, okay, and the reason I'm approaching the stranger is because I've got something that I'm trying to ask them. And that the court would be more flexible with a journalist because it's more reasonable behavior for a journalist than a complete stranger who maybe has developed a strange fetish with some, I don't know, the government.
I think a court, when considering what is reasonable and unreasonable, also have as a backdrop the whole right to media freedom, and keep that in mind. That's going to inform his decision or her decision at the end of the day as well.
I think we need to have some, just think about this a little bit more before we do we need finality at this immediate point?
I think what I would
suggest then is that it remains as an option, obviously not option C, because there's no option A or B. But I would want to urge that those examples that I've given get considered.
So just to get clarity on that, option A was in clause 3, and option B was the standalone clause. Can we delete those so long and just keep the one in clause 6?
Oh, okay, yes. No, we have agreed that if there are going to be any defences, that this is the only place that they're in. Sorry, yeah.
And then I think the obvious
thing, but I think there's agreement that if I'm correct, that the requirement of reasonableness as a defence should come out, because it actually gets too confusing in that you've got to establish unreasonableness to prove harassment, and so if you also have to prove reasonableness as a defence, it's very confusing what you have to prove.
So we flag it?
Yeah.
All right.
Continuing then on page 26, option has been deleted. It was clause 7. Clause 7 the original clause made provision that a protection order remains in force for a period of 5 years. We were requested to delete that, and the other option is retained to the effect that a protection order will be enforced for 5 years, but also such further period as the court may determine on good cause shown. On page 27. Okay, this relates to actually to offences in terms of clause 15.1. The person who contravenes clause 7 is guilty of offence and can be sent to prison for a period of up to 5 years. So an option has been inserted that will kind of exclude the South African police from section 15.1 of the Act, so that if they contravene clause 7, that they that disciplinary steps will be taken against them, and so it will not be regarded as an offence then. And in order to do that, we had to amend clause 7.2, and to make sure that the court may impose certain conditions on the respondent only, and not also on the South African police services, so they excluded from that. But we also, as the clause 2 were initially drafted, clause 2, the police could have been tasked by the court to inter alia seize an arm or a dangerous weapon or accompany a complainant to a certain place, or the court could direct a commander of a police station to further investigate the matter. That is now put in a separate clause, and if you and then specifically in relation to clause 15.1, if that is applied, only the contravention of clauses 7.1 and 2 will then constitute an offence in terms of this option, which will actually exclude the South African police services. Well, that is the main object we try to attain with this amendment.
My reading of seven, the new 7.2, is that we've limited the conditions to being imposed on the respondent, but the court is wide, and I think that's correct. You don't want a court getting over enthusiastic and ordering that this child who's being harassed must be put in a different school. Okay, which, I don't know. So it's harassment order against the protection order against the respondent. So it's additional conditions on the respondent. Okay. Then I thought the problem with the seizing and accompanying the person was that we said that must be done by the police. We didn't want, previously it was an order to seize any weapon, and the police officer must accompany the complainant.
Yeah.
And we've said no, the police must seize the weapons and accompany the complainant where necessary. And then the other aspect is that the station commissioner becomes commander.
Mm.
That's a wording thing. So I'm not quite sure of this issue of the... That's the wording of 7 on the face of it.
Yes.
Okay. Unfortunately, Mr. Roberts has brought up the issue of the exclusion of the police
from. So my understanding is we put those in because of something not related to what he said.
Firstly, Mr. Jeffrey, you're correct. I believe previously it was named the peace officer. That is now substituted with that the court may order a member of the South African Police Service. So we took out peace officer. That is correct. Further amendments to clause 7.2 as it was, is that we substituted a reference to dangerous weapon. But the primary intention, if you read it in conjunction with the option to clause 15.1, is that only the clause 7.1 or 2, that means with as a result of the amendment, will be applicable if a court imposes a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years. In terms of this clause, police will then fall outside the ambit of clause 7.1 and 7.2 due to the fact that we number it.
Yeah. So but it makes sense because 7.3, which is what applies to the police, is a court order. And if they don't comply with the court order, then it's contempt of court, okay, which is a offence on its own, okay. So I tend to agree with the offences only applying to 1 and 2, because if you say they apply to 3, you've in a sense almost double criminalised it, haven't you? Because 7.3 is relates to a court order. So the court orders the police to do something, and if they don't comply with it, then it is contempt of court for not following a court order. This is where my understanding is that there may be other conduct that is criminal that is not just breaking the court order. So in 7.1 and 2, you're being harassed. Your cat arrives dead on your doorstep, and you've got 9 of them, so you're worried that you've got to number 3.
They've nailed it.
Yes. And the court order is stop killing this person's cat and nailing them to the door. You break that order, that's a crime. But in fact, the court says actually investigate this as a crime on its own.
I
don't know, have we got consensus on this or not? I mean, I'm not necessarily even convinced in my own head as I look at it again.
Well, I was waiting for someone to say I'm not happy with this.
Or do I have to be play devil's advocate? You see the 3 is more procedural. 1 and 2 is, I'm also trying to sort of see why the exclusion, 1 and 2 is, sorry, yeah, 1 and 2 is aimed to the respondent, and so it's criminalizing what the respondent has their conduct, if they carry on with it. Whereas 3 is to say to the police, you must seize a weapon, you must accompany the complainant to go and get stuff. And then the station commissioner must investigate. Um,
should we be then, so they've got the protection of the, I mean, if they don't do it, they've defied the court order, but they don't, yeah, they shouldn't be having any involvement in this case. So should we be saying, okay, the policeman refused to go and accompany the complainant to their workplace to go and collect the stuff because they said they didn't have a vehicle? Should we say that's a crime? I mean, they've broken the court order, so they must answer to that. But do we want to impose an additional penalty by saying, no, I'm just wondering if we're going too far. So I'm not clear in my own mind. I'm trying to debate it myself. But as I'm trying to debate it, I'm now getting more convinced of that it only should apply to 7.1 and 2, which effectively relates to the conduct of the complainant, and that it's not necessary to over-regulate the police.
The court would raise it anyway, wouldn't it? Given they've issued the order.
But
Mr. Swift?
I agree, Chair. I don't think one should criminalise three. A court can order that. The court of its own accord could call them back and say, but it's contempt of my order or something.
Yes.
To further criminalise it is not on. I think that the police have got enough problems as it is to try to enforce things, and to additionally criminalise it, I think, would be a problem.
I think I agree, but the argument isn't consistent, because 1 and 2 also amounts to contempt of court. So we're also double criminalising that. If they're doing something wrong, fair enough. And I do think it is in a different category, making police go with people to go and fetch stuff, compared to 1 and 2. But the argument is inconsistent.
But Chair, look, 1 and 2 is the respondent's conduct, the harasser, who this whole, the whole bill is about, the person who's harassing you.
Mm.
So I don't see so much of a contradiction that you I think that if basically, and this harassment is serious, I mean, it can result in death, murder. So you don't want a situation where the court orders the harasser to stop harassing, and they carry on, and they maybe get worse, they maybe get more violent, and they just get hit with contempt of court.
And 1 and 2 can apply to a policeman that is harassing you, as I understand it.
Well, if they're the respondent.
If they were the respondent.
Yes. Yeah.
So you could get a protection order against
3 as officials.
3 as officials just carrying out your
duties or not carrying out.
There's a different...
We're actually creating a crime of harassment, actually, at the end of the day, if they don't comply with the court order. Yeah.
Page 2.
Sorry, I just need to get clarity on what we decide.
We're criminalizing
sub 3.
Yes. 1 and 2.
We're agreeing with the way it is at the moment.
Yeah.
The purple.
Okay.
Option.
No, the cartridges, the cartridges are a hell of an expense. Almost R1,000. Yeah, but we don't all have access to resources that you do, Mr. Jeffries. No. Mr. Jeffries, I've had to change 4 of my cartridges out of my own pocket. Parliament won't reimburse me. They said that's for your expense. R4,000. I've changed mine to black and white. Sorry. Let's make our instructions very clear. Okay.
Basically, we're keeping 7 as amended as it's been given to us now. Okay.
All right.
And 15 also will apply to 1 and 2.
15, we will take out the referencing clause 15.5. Any police member of the police service who fails to comply with the court order referred into 7.3, that subparagraph 3 will come out.
Well, can we not deal with the crimes when we get to 15?
I'd rather we did that, so Mr. Bassett. Otherwise, we're going to be jumping around. Okay. I think the question here, Mr. Jeffrey, is under 7. Which option are we...
We had the way I see it is we had a amendment clause, subclause 2.
Yes.
And that we are going with that amendment.
Okay.
It doesn't actually relate to the police criminality aspect. It was put in for the amendments were there for a specific person, that we don't want the court going wild and putting additional conditions on other people not involved. And we want it to be the police who seize the weapons and accompany the complainant.
Okay, Mr. Bassett. Okay. Say the second option.
We had an original clause 2. That then what we were given now and what we've been discussing is entitled option, and it's breaking clause 2 into...
Yes,
that's
the one we're opting. That's the one
we're opting for, that one.
Right.
And we're not... We'll come back to the issue of criminalization later.
Okay.
Those options are in here for other reasons, as I've expressed.
All right, moving along. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Page 29... relates to the clause relating to one arrest, clause 2,
A2.
The word lapses is substituted with the word expires, so it means that a warrant will expires when the protection order expires, as is determined in clause 6-7. Just some
consequential
amendments that has been affected. It's subclause 4B, the third line. The word harm is being inserted. It's on page 30.
Uh-huh.
And on page 31, I believe that was already inserted previously, the word harm in subclause 5.
That's right.
Okay, on page 31 again, the heading to clause 9, as a result of the amended definition, it's also reworded. It now reads seizure of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequential amendment is indicated in the second line of clause 9. Moving on to page 33, it's clause 12, service of documents, paragraph A. Just the word section is included before the reference to 3A2 and 3B2.
Okay.
Then page 34, it's subclause 4. Again, the court day reference to court day is now specifies ordinary court day. It should now be according to recommendation 5 ordinary court days, obviously. We now busy with the offences section, it's clause 15, it starts on page 33.
Yep.
We probably need to discuss the offences that was raised.
Okay.
Take the committee through it. The original clause 15(1)(a) criminalised the whole section 7, each and every
contravention that mm-hmm. is possible in terms of that clause, and that would have included where a police official or a peace officer, as it was originally worded, or a police officer now, contravenes inter alia the order to accompany a complainant to her house. So you also would have been guilty of an offence in terms of that. The court could have imposed a fine or imprisonment for a period of not exceeding 5 years. The option that has been inserted actually only criminalized section 7, 1 and 2. That is the option. And a contravention of section 7, 1 and 7, 2 relates to the conduct of the respondent.
Mm-hmm.
So if he fails or contravenes section 7, 1 or 2, he would be he or she will be guilty of an offence, and imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years can be imposed. Okay, subclause 2, that is a contravention of clause 5, where the court may order a person or a court may issue an order to the effect that you may not reveal the identity or address of a person, and if a person doesn't comply with that court order, it's guilty of offence, and the court can impose imprisonment for a period of up to 2 years in addition to a fine. Yes, sir.
B. Why do we specifically say 84A? If we do say 84A, surely any affidavit is covered by perjury provisions, in any case. So should we not either say any affidavit in connection with these proceedings, or otherwise leave it out completely and just rely on the perjury provisions?
Please put on your mic. The reference to section 84A relates to affidavit which a complainant makes that the respondent has actually contravened the protection order. So I think the effect is much more serious than all the other affidavits that's being made in terms of the bill, due to the fact that the person will be arrested. The consequences thereof is somehow harsher than the other affidavits. I think that was why we differentiated between the original or between that kind of affidavit that's being made and the other affidavits.
False complaint, it's not covered. It would just be ordinary perjury, or would be covered in some other law.
Mm.
It's not an offence in terms of this act that you lay a false complaint. The only thing you've made an offence is if you get your harassment, or you get your protection order, and you then allege that the person broke the order, and that results in them getting arrested. That's a crime. Okay, I agree that should be a crime that's quite serious. I'm just not sure whether there's enough protection. I mean, you don't want to put people off applying for protection orders, but you do want a safeguard for somebody who is making false accusations under oath.
Chairperson, if I may, in section 13, you have the costs order for people who are making false statements. So there may be a cost order made against them where they have acted frivolously, vexatiously, or unreasonably.
I don't know if that is. I mean, all that does is put the, let's say, the innocent respondent back in the same position, in theory, financially, that they would have been had the application not been made.
did you not look at this issue in the with the Law Commission as to, you don't want to make it too onerous to apply for a protection order and put people off, but at the same time, somebody who vexatiously, maliciously, whatever else, alleges that they're being harassed and therefore they need to be protected from that person, there's no penalty.
So if I may show you, the Law Reform Commission did not look at that aspect of criminalising behaviour of that nature. This reflects a mirror image of what is provided for in the Domestic Violence Act.
It is important that this is consistent with the Domestic Violence Act.
So we don't provide for it.
So I think maybe not provide for it, but maybe it's something to be looked at with both, particularly seeing the Domestic Violence Act has been in existence for some time, whether it is necessary.
Don't want to be consistent with it.
I think in this respect, I think it's something to look at more broadly. I would be worried about if you now suddenly criminalised making false complaints when the whole ramifications of it haven't been properly looked at.
It's not perjury, is it?
Made a false affidavit, it would be perjury, and I mean, they probably could get charged with, well, not defeating the ends of justice. I mean, would it apply under that?
Could lay a charge.
They could lay a charge under perjury, I'm sure. And then isn't there a statutory perjury? No, that won't apply here. But they could lay a charge here.
Yeah. That's right. So we don't provide for it, leave it, eh?
That's another issue. I mean, on the police, do you think we should maybe say that it's a misconduct if they don't comply? Are we still getting there? Okay.
I wanted to raise, it's a new one, just because I was for the first time now checking the cross-referencing the sections. Under 15.3, a person who contravenes or fails to comply with section 4.3. Now, section 4.3 is a person who's subpoenaed, who doesn't pitch up, which is already a crime. If you don't comply with the subpoena, you've committed a crime, contempt.
Oh, so we don't...
I'm just asking, I mean, Mr. Roberts is shaking his head. Why do we want to...
reinvent the wheel.
Why do we want a sort of double penalty? This was an introduced bill, so you obviously had some reason for it to go in, but I'm not sure. It 4.3 applies to subpoenaed people.
I'm going to make the argument that this is probably to go back and research it, but I know it's a court of law which issues a subpoena, and yes, if you don't comply with that, you also did an offence. I agree with that. I have to agree with the chair.
Can it be looked at? I mean, I don't know if it slipped through, but it doesn't make it. So that's basically 15.3. Is it necessary because it's somebody who's failing to comply with a subpoena which is already... has penalties.
Chair, just on that note, it's not really an answer when we will go and have a look at it, but as far as my memory serves me correctly, there are provisions of this nature also in the Criminal Procedure Act, and they are specifically criminalised, and I think the penalties are in line with what we've done here, but we'll need to go and I'll need to verify that. So if a person that's even warned or by court or subpoenas and they don't appear in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, there are specific penalty clauses for those.
But then it gets down to the same argument, if it's covered by criminal procedure, we don't need to recover it.
Mm.
so much. This is in a civil environment, so it might not be covered.
Okay, yeah, but presumably a subpoena has force of law in civil matters. What is the force of law?
Two on that chair.
All right, let's just flag that one. Yes, please.
Okay. On page 34, starts with offences that can be committed by electronic communication service provider. Okay. First one that is criminalized is the time period within which information in terms of the direction must be given to a court. We did some redrafting to subclause 4, 2, and 3. Previously it was stated that if a person in a willful or in a grossly negligent manner made a false statement, we requested to take the false requirement out. We actually redrafted it in accordance with other authorities, or not authority, other sections which contain similar provisions, and that clauses now reads, makes a false statement in the affidavit referred to, and then we quoted all the sections, or in this case the clauses that were previously inserted. We actually shortened it, and the false statement must be made in a material respect, otherwise a mere mistake maybe may amount to a false statement. So that is just something that is inserted in most of the other provisions that deals with this matter. Okay, and the affidavits referred to this inter alia, the affidavit if they ask for extension or if they are requested to give additional information, or the affidavit that relates to reasons why they cannot furnish the information. Okay, and then the penalties imposed on the electronic communication service providers is stipulated as offence by the electronic communication service provider itself to a fine not exceeding 10,000 rand. It's substantially less than RICA. Or if it's an employee of an electronic communication service provider, to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding a period of 6 months.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apology for my intermittent attendance. But I'm coming to at a propitious time, because this is a matter which has been of great concern to me. And as I read 3A and this section, this clause 15, the structure is that the court requests the information. If there is no response, an offense is made. Now, what seems to be lacking in the reading of the two sections is a clear language which indicates that an offense is only committed if the information is readily available and capable of being supplied without expenses. We don't want to understood that we don't want to create an obligation on the electronic service providers to set up information and registries which they would not otherwise do of their own accord. But left it as it is, if I were an electronic service provider under the penalty of criminal sanctions, I would set up structures to be ready to provide information should, if and when the court asks. And I would begin asking people for names, addresses when they consume my service and when they contract with me. When right now it's not required, anyone can open an email address without providing any information.
But in terms of RICA, they do.
No, Mr. Chairman, if I may. The electronic service provider is also an internet service provider. Is that correct? Yes. So if the information is available, it's fine. But you can open an email account with MWeb or with Yahoo without any disclosure of identity. And that's not a requirement.
No, it's coming changed.
Well, I open them all the time, I promise. Aha, yes, I knew we were going to say. As it stands now, that's not required. I don't know of any legislation which requires, if you open an email account, and therefore you create an identity, an internet identity, for the internet service provider to verify that identity. You know, we all open blogging accounts, etc. I mean, nobody asks us for identity. We just pick up a username and a password, and that's our identity.
Well, I was going to say, look, I think there are some legal requirements with, you know, if you have your own internet service provider, you have your own internet service provider. Although you can get email addresses and things without. But the issue is basically page 16 of I think we've all got different versions, but the communication service provider can apply for cancellation on the direction that it must supply the detail on the grounds that the requested information is not available in the records of the electronic communication service provider.
How do you pay?
Mr. Chairman,
to give your details.
It's advertisement driven. These are all services which are provided for free, and you get the advertisement. If you want to upgrade to an advertisement free setting, you end up paying. Then you pay with internet. But the overwhelming majority of people bear the advertisement and get a free service. Facebook, it's a typical example.
But Chair, let's not talk about that issue. It's the issue of his concern was that, that onerous responsibility. I mean, we did, Mario, discuss while you were out. But I think the issue is if the records are not available, that is a ground for cancelling the direction.
Yeah. As I understand it, so just to get out of here. As I understand the way it works, order, failure, sanction. Criminal sanction. In between, one is to go to court and ask for a cancellation. So if there is an order and you don't ask for the cancellation, you go to jail. It's just the way all this is structured. It's not the right way. We are enlisting a private entity in doing the job of the police. They are forced by law to provide information. They should not be under criminal sanction for not having exercised an undue burden of telling them that they don't have the information and ask for the cancellation of the order. I think we should build in the law itself that there is a crime only when you give information that you have. And I think we should put, just for clarity, because there is the chilling effect, the unintended consequence effect, for clarity we should put in the legislation that no one is required to set up information or acquire information that he would not otherwise mirror on account of this legislation. I can phrase it more elegantly, but these are the two concepts. You don't have the information, you don't need to go to apply to court. You just give what they have. If you don't have it and you haven't applied to court, you cannot go to jail just for that reason. Jails are terrible places. I think we should be more careful about these criminal sections.
Well, you've obviously been there. So, JJ, sorry.
The difficulty is that in order to stop cyber harassment, you need to have some provisions to get the identity of the respondent from the service provider.
And the address.
Yeah, the identity and the address of the service provider, so you can start getting the protection order. The service provider can go back and find that we don't have the records, and then that's it, the order gets cancelled. I don't think, I mean, it's quite unheard of. I mean, where you want the service providers or anyone to do something, you specify what they must do. I really think a clause to the service providers saying you don't need to do anything extra is ridiculous. I mean, they can see that from the bill. The bill doesn't place any new requirements on them, and there is a defense if the records are not available. It is expressly put there. So I think that kind of clause, elegantly phrased or not, is a bit absurd. And then if you don't provide a sanction for not providing the information, well, then they won't do it. So what's the point of making the requirement in the first place?
If people, if companies now suddenly feel obliged, then that's not a legal obligation, and I would imagine people would have the right to say, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to give it. I don't have to, there's no obligation on me to give it.
Yeah.
And then they don't have to give it. So I don't think that's, I mean, we haven't imposed an additional obligation in the bill, then there isn't an additional obligation.
Chairperson, moving on. The next sub-clause deals with the South African Police Services. Okay. This is the one we were addressing.
This is the one we were arguing. I mean, look, I agree with it. If we're going to have it,
Be there or it must come out.
Look, the issue was whether they were criminalised under the whole of 7. I agree with the separation, that you separate out the sort of baddies with the people who are just lazy or performing in an administrative capacity. I don't know. I mean, I agree with it. We have it of it being separate. I don't have particularly strong views on whether it is there or not there.
Okay, the subclause 5 criminalise the conduct from police in relation to clause 3B1B, where the court may order the South African Police Services to investigate incidents of harassment to determine a person's name and address. The first kind of conduct that is criminalised, is where the South African Police fails to comply with the direction issued in terms of section 3B1B. One can also argue, on the other hand, that due to the fact that it's again an order of court, and if you don't comply with the order of the court, it's an offence in any event, that we have criminalised it. And then the other conduct that is being criminalised relates to the information, the period, sorry, within which the information must be given to a court, as well as where application is made for extension of the period. And if the court order persons in terms of section 7B, that is where they ask the South African Police to accompany a complainant to a place of a residence in the area to collect things or to collect a firearm, or similar conduct is criminalised in terms of clause 5A. Relating to false statements, we have we got rid of the willful and negligent manner and how to make a false statement, and we substituted it with a new wording, and we also compressed it a bit more so that that particular clause, it's the B part now, leads, makes a false statement in the affidavit referred to in 3B, 3A, 4B, or 3C5, which is incorrect. That 5 should be substituted, I think, with a 3.
So it's 3C3.
In the material respect. And the penalty imposed is a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 6 months. And, carry on. Then clause 15.6, what is criminalized here is the failure of a person when requested in terms of section 3C2 to give his name and address to the police, and he gives a false name or address, or he fails to do that, in that event he will actually commit a criminal offense, and the penalties that can be imposed is a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 6 months.
I'm quite interested in the people who keep on wanting to support the police if you're not doing their jobs, but I'm inclined to agree on A and on the A part.
A, right.
That perhaps we don't criminalise that, but that the affidavit, I think we should leave there. I mean, if they make a false statement in affidavit, then they should be, and as police officers even more so, they would even bigger responsibility. So I would perhaps look at maybe, but then we must specify that it's that. I would say we should specify in the Act that any contravention of any of this, in 7 as well as here, is misconduct. And that must be dealt with accordingly by the Secretariat or whatever.
Let's look carefully, and I think David supports with that, and there's no reason, but have you ever seen what happens to a policeman that's put in jail for 6 months? That, so let's face some reality of what goes on in our prisons as well. But
so, JJ, A comes out.
Sorry?
A comes out.
A is actually just a direction. So it's not this is, I suppose, a court order. But is it? It's not the same as. Is it the same as a court order? Will you be guilty of contempt of court?
Okay.
But then B also relates to you don't you the difference between 1 and 2 is that you don't comply. 1, you just don't bother to comply with the direction at all. B is you do comply with the direction, but you just don't get the information to court. And and 7.3 is this thing about those other court orders. I mean, again, it's not.
not wanting to protect the police, and I think if I'm having problems with domestic violence, with the police not doing things, but how has that been dealt with, and is it not better to deal with it? Because these are effectively not performing your functions properly. The normal law can apply in terms of breaking orders, but should we not be specifying that this is misconduct? I don't know what misconduct is, whether there's a definition of it, which needs to be investigated by the ICD. Deal with it that way. I don't know how the amendments to the ICD bill and domestic violence have gone. I know that they've gone to, it's now the secretariat that are investigating. Would it not be better let the normal law of contempt and whatever court apply, but you don't want the police just to somehow not do it and things, so you want a bit stronger than, you don't maybe want to go as far as specifically providing that they get criminalized and then they won't implement this because they don't support it, but that there's some mechanism for ensuring that it's properly investigated. But Debbie claims to know the ICD Secretariat Amendment. I don't know whether one could fit things in that.
No, the Secretariat is basically now going to be responsible for dealing with sort of what they would classify as minor misconduct. The ICD is only going to be doing like deaths in prison, you know, shootings and killings of by police and so on, the more serious issues. So the Secretariat is going to now be responsible for misconduct issues. The domestic violence hasn't been effective at all, which is my major concern, and that is what I want to avoid here, because they've provided for the ICD to give them exemption from even disciplinary action against misconduct if they don't comply with domestic violence provisions. And the result has been, for 10 years, the vast majority of the stations haven't complied, because they don't regard it as important. And I have a problem with the attitude, because they don't support it. It's an act of this country. They don't have a choice whether they support it. And that's been the attitude. So it is a concern. I mean, what happens if they get the information and then they don't furnish it to court, and then the person can't get the harassment order? They can't get the protection order. Then what? Now, I'm not sure what the solution is, but, a lot of it is, willingness of the department and efficiency in managing the misconduct investigations too, which we obviously can't legislate for. But I do think there needs to be some kind of stronger incentive to make them actually do what they have to do.
Bearing in mind is the option of a fine there, but Steve, let me hear you.
I fully appreciate the difficulties with domestic violence and that almost recalcitrance from the side of police, but we said, what is the solution? Misconduct, criminalized, because now if we set it here, then we're going to have to carry it through with every piece of legislation we deal from here, because we're now starting a new standard. Do we want to do that? We need to debate that. We'll be doing the trafficking bill, we're going to do the same, setting that criminal standard throughout. But maybe we have to. I don't know. I'm just debating it. It just is a new standard. Have we given the new inspectorate we passed that legislation time to find its feet yet? Maybe we should go that route and see that should, the misconduct special inspectorate route.
On the criminal issue, there is, when we did the forensic bill on police, the fingerprinting thing, we did provide therefore criminal penalties for police, because there was very serious consequences of not. So there is precedent on that score, but it was very serious. It was if they, used the fingerprints for purposes of things that they shouldn't be doing, like framing people and things like that, which is obviously serious. So we may not wish to criminalise, perhaps. But otherwise we must look at misconduct for all of us and see how it goes with the Secretariat. I'm not quite sure.
JJ. Coming with a more fixed position. We've said that the direction under 5A1 would be contempt of court. So I think it was a general view that should not be included.
No.
Two, I'm not sure why it's there.
because it's the same direction under 3B1. You get the information, but you don't bring it to court. So you haven't complied with the direction. So it's really the same.
Same thing.
The same thing. Within the time periods and things like that. But the direction is, go get this information and bring it back to court, back to us by such and such a date. So if you half do it, you go and get the information, but you leave it in your car, and you don't bring it to court in time, you haven't complied with the direction. So surely one and two are dealing with the same thing, and if there's agreement that that's covered by contempt of court. And then 7.3, we did discuss it, is again, orders by the court, and you're in contempt again if you haven't complied with that.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it's already covered. The fingerprint stuff that Debbie's talking about, presumably that is not an existing crime, so you had to create one. I agree there's a problem of police not complying, but I think we've then got to look at the Domestic Violence Act as a whole. I mean, there was a parliamentary hearing. I don't know what they resolved on this issue, and why are the police not implementing, and what can we do about it? But basically, in short, I think because all these aspects are covered already, I don't think we need to criminalise them specifically. But we do need to keep the problem of police not doing what they're meant to be doing to look at solutions. My other problem here is I'm quite anxious that we finalise this bill, because if we leave it and come back to it, we will have forgotten half of what we agreed to and why we wanted to agree to it. And something like this, we do actually need to also engage with the police portfolio committee. So I'm also arguing from the point of view of, if we wanted to include these provisions, we then probably would need to engage with the police committee just for their views. I mean, we don't have to, but if we want to start having if the police starts imposing penalties on judges, we wouldn't be that happy. So maybe it's better to then leave out five. But my main argument is it's already covered in terms of contempt of court. No, contempt of court. Statement is under oath. Perjury. But we do the failure on the part of some members of the police to do what they're meant to do, particularly with regard to domestic violence, and this is problematic and is worrying, and we need to look at it further, maybe putting that in the report that we want to engage further on it.
It might go somewhere in assisting, but just to remind members that there are directions and instructions that can be issued by the National Commissioner, and those national instructions in terms of Clause 17 must provide that adequate disciplinary steps will be taken against a prosecutor or police official who fails to comply with any of these things, and perhaps we could strengthen that provision to make sure that the National Commissioner talks in these instructions about how directions must be complied with and the time periods that must be complied with. I don't know whether that will assist in taking the matter forward.
Okay. Christine.
Just remember something. I mean, I haven't looked at the DVA for a long time, but there are reporting requirements, and I'm not too sure if you know, have misconduct kind of things or people not complying. I don't know whether we should be looking at, I mean, how will we know that if the police haven't actually done what they're meant to do?
Reporting requirements are from your RCD, and the National Commissioner has to report on the DVA, which I don't think he's ever done. And we've raised it already there, and he ignored it further. And then then there was a reporting by the RCD of misconduct exemptions that they gave and inspections that they did. But they give a sort of a selection of police stations 1 year, and then the following year they give a different selection of different ones. So there's no follow-up from 1 year to the next, as to which, what happened to the case. They just say, there was this, and they gave exemption, and that was it. Or they did misconduct, and the person was dismissed. They do give some indication. But there's no consistent follow-up. When they, a lot of the things, they just say, well, it's still ongoing, or postponed, or whatever, and you never get to find out what actually happened.
Alright, so five comes out.
What has been deleted from clause 15 wasn't earlier subclauses 7 and 8. 7 dealt with the abuse of the 3C process by the South African police. And then subclause 8 gave the district court extended jurisdiction to also impose a penalty provided for in clause 15.1, which must now be dealt with by regional court if the prosecutor feels that the court will impose a fine of more than 3 years. Okay, moving on. Okay, I want to take the committee to the schedule, to the bill. Sorry. No.
Maybe it's actually for us, not for for Mr. Roberts, that the issue is basically, do we want, there are various regulations, there are regulations by the minister, there's policy directives by the National Director of Public Prosecution, mm-hmm. and there's police instructions.
Yeah.
Do we want the power to approve those? Now, I see there is a document which the research unit has prepared.
Yes.
Because we'd asked last time, give us the reasons why.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the document's general.
Okay,
it's the general powers of Parliament to approve regulations. And it's not, the question I was looking for was, why do we want the power for these regulations to approve? And my difficulty is that it's quite an onerous task that you give yourself to approve regulations. And we did it with the Child Justice Bill, and I think we were right in that regard. But it took considerable time on the part of this committee. And I just think we need to be careful about when we want to invoke it. We can run around making all regulations subject to approval by Parliament, but then you find that, one, we don't have the time to get through all the regulations, and two, it delays the implementation of legislation because they can't get it together to the departments or the NPA or whatever to bring them. So I'm not against us having to approve the regulations and the directives and everything else. I just want to be sure when we are taking on a responsibility that we are taking it on for a specific reason. Child justice was a whole new change of law, a whole new approach. It was, I think, necessary. This is a much smaller component about a sort of smaller remedy. And I'm not sure... I'm not sure whether we want to have that full power. And unfortunately, the document from the research section, as far as I can see, doesn't address why we want, it's a general thing, why we want the power to approve these regulations.
what we could do, what I could do is actually go through the bill and just put out all the places where it's prescribed and regulations, and then you could have a chance to actually see what you'd be wanting to approve or not approve. My sense is that it's mostly kind of administrative, like forms and notices and stuff like that. Mm. But, you know, just for that, to be sure that to go through every single one and check. Mm. National instructions are slightly different.
No. So I don't know if we, I don't know that we have the authority to approve national instructions. I don't think we do. I agree with JJ in general principle. I mean, that we don't have the time to go through everything. But I think it would be useful if Christine could do that for us, just to make quite sure. I mean, my view has always been, if we want something really important, it should be in the Act anyway, and leave that more administrative things to regulations. I don't think we should be leaving anything that's vitally important to regulations in any case, other than for administrative purposes. So if we could do that, I think that would be useful.
So that's flagged. Policy directives.
Okay, policy directions.
Just on that, so we're flagging, we're keeping it open about whether we have
yes.
the power to approve the regulations.
Yes.
That's okay. I was going to move on to policy directives, because do we have the power to approve national instructions? If we don't, then it would be then it would need to remain about submitting any national instructions before they take effect.
I'm sure the committee approved the national instructions that were issued under the Child Justice Act. Yeah.
And the
directives of the national NDPP.
All right.
In general, I think the same consideration applies here as with regulations. Then options has been provided. So the committee must just consider again if it must be submitted to Parliament, or must we give Parliament the authority to approve this. In any event, I believe something like national instructions is almost the same as subordinate legislation, regulations, and that there is no prohibition of submitting that to Parliament in general for approval.
I'm thinking as I go along, so this is also not even a party position, so my comrades can disagree with me, but I would want to caution that I think we're flagging it, but in an effort to move things forward, if we want to, I don't think we need to, we want to acquire too many responsibilities of approving regulations. And as Ms. Schaefer said, that which is important should be in the main bill. So I would want to argue to everybody that if we're going to say we want to approve the regulations or the directives or the national instructions, let members of the committee come with a particular instruction regulation that they're worried about, that they feel is so vital that it needs parliamentary approval. Otherwise, let's keep it as it is. So in the next meeting, can we try and finalize it by either people will come and say, look, this particular, Christine's putting them all out generally. Maybe she can circulate it. But if anybody wants us to approve the regulations, let them come and say, this particular power, we feel these regulations are highly sensitive. We don't want to just leave it up to the minister to deal with. We want the power to approve.
I think that's fine. I was just wondering about another a possibility. I mean, is there any way we could maybe say that we can review them if we need to at any time? So that we can see, we don't need, even if we don't necessarily want to approve them right now, leave them up to the minister, and then we can see if certain issues come up at any stage as being problematic, we can then call for those regulations or instructions to come to the committee at that point.
Well, they are submitted to Parliament anyway.
Yeah, but if we don't have to approve them, we don't have to change them. I mean, we need the power to be able to make changes, maybe, if there are problems that arise later on. Could we do something like that in the poll?
I suppose one can insert a clause like that, but I believe if there's a problem with regulations, it will have to affect where the Act is not functioning in practice, and it will automatically be reviewed by the Department, and it will then be obviously be again submitted to Parliament. I don't know, we'll have to come up with it.
I can't recall that we've ever done a provision like that, so we're going to have a look. I just want to remind members that even this provision that is there where you just submit to Parliament, I don't even know whether it's really... it is necessary in the sense that they must come to Parliament before they're promulgated, but all subordinate legislation in terms of the Interpretation Act is supposed to come to Parliament in any event. And I think the idea is then if members of Parliament have problems with anything, they would recommend the necessary interventions.
I'm not sure. Mr. Ambrosini?
We can't change the regulations. I mean, that's, from a formal viewpoint, we give the power. There will be no mechanism through which we can put pen to paper and change the regulation. But if I may just ask an erratic question, I haven't applied my full mind to it. It is customary to give the minister the power to adopt regulations to implement an act, and it's becoming sort of a habit. But does, in respect of this specific act, is there an actual need, proven need for the minister to pass regulations? Yes. Okay. I'm just concerned about things being expanded definitionally.
Look, I mean, the we delegate the part of the, I mean, there are things like, I mean, the issue of service and I mean, it maybe needs to be done in a special way, that kind of thing. So there is more detail to be filled in. There's quite a lot provided for. But you know, with regulations, we I mean, there's various ways of dealing with it. We delegate it to the minister, our legislative capacity. We then have, I mean, we can say we don't have the power to amend regulations. We keep the power to approve them if we want to. So in child justice, we had to approve regulations, and there was a to-ing and fro-ing of they tabled them. We didn't like things. We wanted change. They took them away again. They brought them back until we were happy with the product, and then we approved them. So that's the sort of most onerous task. The other is that. A sort of suspensive veto where you table them and then Parliament has a period within which to reject them, and if it doesn't reject them, then they're deemed approved.
Not a bad idea.
My problem with that is you've still got to apply your mind, you know, you've and then ultimately it would just be tabling. I don't know how many get tabled, and that it gets tabled, I don't know how much of it gets out to members. But obviously if there's something in a regulation and we don't like it, we can then do an amendment to the bill. You know, I think where I'm going is the delayed approval, you know, that it must be tabled for a period beforehand. That's actually not much different to the approval, because you've still got to, it gives you the opportunity to refuse it if you want to, but you've still actually, if you're going to do your job properly, you've got to go through the regulations, and then it does become problematic if you want to change things, and sometimes you want to change things just because they're better the way you want them, but it's not a train smash if it were left the way it was. So I'm tending towards feeling let's leave the bill as it was. The minister must table before they're introduced, which also may not be necessary, but at least it hopefully alerts the Justice Committee secretary
or Parliament, that when they're tabled, that they're then sent to members, and we put it on our program if we want a briefing. But I think, Chair, let's give an opportunity still to anyone who feels very strongly that a particular regulation should be subject to greater scrutiny, but to come and argue that at another meeting. At the moment, we don't really know what regulations or what sections we're looking at.
Okay. So that's it then. The rest is the schedule. Yes.
Chairperson, there's a couple of amendments that's probably not portrayed in a document that has been submitted to the committee. The first one relates to amendments proposed to the Domestic Violence Act 1998. That I think it starts in this document on page 42. In the amended or the proposed clause 4A, 1, the word thing must be substituted with object. That's on page 42. It's in the lower column, the third column. And also, if on the other page, on the other side, again, the word thing must be substituted with the word object. Then the Firearms Control Act, the first amendment to section 120 of the Firearms Control Act is in order, but the second one needs to be amended and should read as follows. In terms of section 14(1)(a) of the Protection from Harassment Act, section 14(1)(a) 15151A of the Protection of Harassment Act 2011. That is where the conduct of a respondent is criminalised if he does not comply with the protection order. And that's the only thing that we actually want to catch up a virtue of this amendment to Schedule 2. The court can actually declare a person to be you can hold an investigation and declare a person incompetent to possess a firearm for purposes of the Firearms Control Act. And we don't want to catch all the other offences that's committed in terms of the law. That's valid.
Okay. Mr. Amrassini.
Sorry, I come to this less prepared than I was the last time I raised this point, so I will not raise it as well as I did the last time, but the point was not addressed well, not as well, not okay. I can't wait until this gets passed. You're the first one person I against when I okay deep. Now I raised the point that it seemed as if the amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act, so those at the end of page 40, and the Domestic Violence Act, are not related to this bill, and they would apply to all aspects of criminal procedures. And if that were the case, it would seem as if just the opportunity has been taken of minor amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act to load these onto this train that is moving. And if that's the case, I indicate that perhaps they should be taken out and separate consideration should be given, because we haven't really received submissions or anything specifically dealing with the merits of these amendments. They were going to respond to me.
Are you in a position to respond?
as a chairperson, not. I can make up an argument if it's necessary. So, you respond on the return date, rather.
Chair, we'll respond when you return, but you know, the poll was published for comments, so when comments were made, it was on these, and I think they do improve in certain respects some of the acts that are being amended. I think Dr. Ambrosini might be right that they're not, strictly speaking, all consequential amendments, but they do make improvements, and I don't see any reason why Parliament can't, that's within its legislative competence to make these amendments. They have a bearing on this Act. But anyway, we'll come back to you with a more considered response.
Okay. All right. Now, the way forward. No, not lunch. No. So, meeting is scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday. Thursday next week's a holiday. Will this be the A-list or not?
We'll have to discuss finally those issues of approval of regulations, get the thing
first.
From Christine, yeah.
First.
Okay. Yes, please, if we could just do that. And then we had to sort of flag the issue of the defences.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Mario's point about the disclosing of identities, if we can maybe just have some time to discuss that with our caucus.
Sorry, what does that mean? Can we finalise this on Tuesday?
Well, yes, I hope so. Debbie? Yeah? We'll have enough time to apply our minds.
Because I think if we can try and aim to finalise next week,
Tuesday,
well, Tuesday sort of the informal, and then maybe the voting on Wednesday, that would be good. My concern is, and I mean, it just was brought home by looking at the regulations, the one on the firearms. You know, they were referring to this as Protection from Harassment Act of 2009, and that's even before. And my worry is that the moment we leave it, we then start forgetting what we agreed to.
All right, honourable members, can we accept that as the way forward? All right. You come back on Tuesday, we go through, well, we give you what our decision is, and then on Wednesday you produce the A-list. Is that okay, Mr. Bassett?
Just from a technical point of view, do we continue working on the dirty document and then come, or do we work on it?
No, I think they can start the B version. What is it called? The B version. The B bill. Because it's actually only it's two, three sections that are necessary. And then on this thing of regulations, for example, it's going to be whether there's two words for approval,
yeah,
three
stay
words or not.
Out.
And then the defences thing is going to be in or out.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. Vunani.
But Chair, then we're hoping to finalise the bill
Tuesday.
Tuesday and
vote on Wednesday. All right. That thing about the public protector is not for the committee. All right. Fine. Well, that means we're done. No. All right. Thank you very much.